functioning? Yep. Is it working? Not yet. Can you hear me if I'm talking? Back up in Yovik again? No, it's turned on. I don't see any other buttons. Check one and two. Anything there? You have it now? Okay. Can we turn one of these lights off, maybe? No idea where the control is. Oh. Oh, that'll have to do. It's all right. We don't have a lot. So, thanks for coming back. On a beautiful, lovely, sunny day in Jovik, Norway. Again, I could be in Italy or here. So what we discussed last time is, last time, certainly you remember, we went over Widgetco server. It was attacked by an external attacker, and the idea is now we get to look at the attacker's system. So the police went and confiscated a system in a university, and I'll explain the scenario in a little bit. The challenge that I have, and the reason that I want to give a presentation, and there's only a few slides here, and I do have to take a call at 3:30, so I apologize. So I'll have to take a pause to take that call. The idea here is that I do have to give you a little bit of an overview. We looked at logs, which are going to be relevant on a user system. We looked at bash history, for example. That's certainly going to be relevant on a user system. Some of the external messages, secure logs, those may be relevant as well. So we have that, a basis for that. What I wanted to give you here now is an overview of the user-based artifacts that we're going to look at. Normally in a server investigation, these aren't required to look at. So this time when we're looking at a user system, there's a lot more artifacts we need to get. So in thinking of our scenario, the idea, of course, is that the attacker compromised the server. But our challenge as investigators, if we look at the attacker system, is trying to tie those actions back to a person. Okay, so we'll get into the scenario in a bit, but basically the system was seized out of an area where just about anybody could have used it. So it's better to tie the action. It's difficult to tie the actions back to a specific user. So you have to look, when you do the forensic, at other things around it to show that this is a behavior-based, and we can determine that it was actually the owner of the system that did it. That's what we're going to try and do here. So some of the artifacts we're going to look at are going to be, again, the home directory stuff, the bash history. We haven't talked about web browsing, email, or chat box yet. Most of the time, a user system of a Nix is going to be Linux. So we're going to be looking at primarily either thanks for watching. It looks like we're on, but I think I have a bad battery, so it might die again. I'll watch it. Where were we? User directory or home directories again? Usually in the yeah, it's going to die again. I see it. I don't see any batteries up here. Seems back on. Okay, home directories, again, usually found in home of the username or with the username, but it can be customized, of course. It can be changed. To find it officially, you should look at the etsy passwd file. And when you remove a user account, these are by default not deleted, so we can recover information after the fact. Home directories store a lot of information beyond what the user intentionally stored. They're usually applications will store things in the home directory as well in a hidden subdirectory. So something that starts with a dot in Linux will hide it effectively. And we'll find most of our artifacts in our investigation will exist in the. Those two batteries are dead, by the way, Jan. Switched them out already. Yeah, but those ones are dead, just so you don't put them back in. User stuff is in the home directory, so if you're familiar with Windows forensics, that would be equivalent to something like the ntuser.dat, whereas the system stuff is in the /etc directory and is specific for configuration globally. And logging, again, we're going to find logs in our var log by default. User history, still going to be very relevant information, maybe even more so, to see what the user was doing, how they were typing commands, what commands they were typing at the command line. Users will hit the command line in a Linux environment. It's almost unavoidable even in the customized world today. Unfortunately, they're easily changed because they're plain text and we don't have timestamps. But we can put together some type of chronological viewpoint of what the attacker did that helps us tell the story. So in our scenario specifically, we want to tell the story of what the attacker did, how they did it in some type of narrative functionality that the layperson can understand. So we want the technical details to back up our executive summary, so to speak, but we want to be able to translate that into a chronological story, typically. So using the user history, you can use this to record or to corroborate we can use it to corroborate. Again, we don't have timestamps, but we can use it to corroborate. If we think that the attacker created a file or folder, then we may be able to determine a time of that action out of the history. Typo patterns. So if we go back one slide, you can see sometimes we'll find that the users will make typos. The second one, for example, is S-U-O-D instead of S-U-D-O. And you can start to correlate behavior. Oftentimes doing Linux forensics, I'll find commands that were typed that are Windows equivalents that normally fail, and vice versa doing Windows investigation. You may find Linux commands. Attackers get lost and forget what they're doing. So other patterns you can look for, I think I mentioned this the last time, is that I always type my tar expression the exact same way when I'm untarring a file. And it may be that I always type it with dash XFJPF, whatever. Sometimes you can see that a different administrator was on the system because the style of commands or the order that they're in, we're creatures of habit, can be different. Right, so web browsers are almost unlimited in the amount of web browsers there are today. And there's, you know, popular ones and less popular ones. Internet Explorer does not work on Mac or Linux anymore, so we don't have to worry about that. Check. There we are. Yeah. Okay. Sorry. We have more batteries. So web browsers change. They're notoriously not secure. They're a point of attack of a lot of attackers out there. So they're constantly updated. It is impossible to keep updated all the time as to which changes are made. And sometimes they make changes that go to extremes. Sometimes it's little bug fixes, and sometimes Internet Explorer, for example, changed from version 9 to version 10, included a change that no longer uses index.dat databases. It now uses the extensible storage engine database. So major change. It doesn't affect the front end. The users don't feel it, but when you do the forensic examination, you're going to see something's different. Right? You're not going to find index.dat files anymore. It's all stored in one database file, ESE file. Other things that can happen are Firefox changed, right? So Mozilla changed over the years. It used to use its own specific database type. Now it is using almost exclusively SQLite databases, which are more understood than their proprietary database. So, good for us. A little side note is that Firefox artifacts function the same way on Windows as they do in Linux and Mac systems. So, because again, Internet Explorer uses the Windows registry to store a lot of functionality, settings, preferences, and whatnot, we have to know how to look at the registry. With Firefox, it doesn't matter. It's a portable type of browser where we can see the same artifacts on the systems. So we have a couple of ways to look at this. First of all, some of the sources of evidence are going to be the history, which is the URL browsing history. Cookies, any typed or form data, downloads, even active session information we can get. And again, lucky for us, Firefox 3 does this almost all in SQL, and later, Firefox 3 and later, stores it almost all in SQLite databases. Most of the browsers based on Mozilla technology will store data in these SQLite databases. So in Firefox, it's going to be stored, data is going to be stored in a profile. So each user that uses the Firefox will get a profile in their home directory. The tilde means home. So then .mozilla, Firefox, and then there's going to be a random string. It's probably not random. It's probably some kind of hash value of some type. We just don't know, and frankly, we don't care. It's not forensically interesting to us, so nobody's bothered to figure out what's going on here. And then dot default. And all the profiles, so the user can have multiple profiles as well when he or she is browsing the internet and using these this browser, Firefox browser. That's not common, but we're going to create our own so that we can actually do some examination. Inside the profile directory then will be some of the important ones for us forensically are cookies, downloads, form history, and places, all SQLite extensions. So good for us. SQLite is a pretty good open source project. And we can use native SQLite tools to look at the data inside these SQLite files. We can use SQLite Manager, for example, to open the databases interactively and really see what's going on. What we can't do with native tools like SQLite Browser or SQLite Manager is we can't look at deleted data. I assure you that when an internet history is cleared in Firefox, that data is not wiped. It's just deleted from casual observation and marked as available for use. So we're not going to get into digging through unallocated or deleted data in Firefox internet history. There is a pretty good paper or some research that has been done out there by Paul Sanderson. Paul Sanderson has done a lot of research into deleted SQLite database entries. He's got some tools out there that you can use to get that out. So if you're limited on tools, you can use the SQLite database browser. Or we can look at we have to pull the files out from our system. So in this case, we have a screenshot showing us all the SQLite database files from cookies down to searches, places, form history, etc. So I have to take a pause here, and I apologize, I'm going to need my computer. So you have the images, the Dimitri images. See if you can't get those mounted. Remember last time we had one that was very complex and one that was simple? This one's a simple one. So see if you can't get this one mounted. And this call will probably be about 30 minutes. Thanks. Okay, any luck getting those mounted? No? All right, we'll work on that in a few minutes. Let's get through just a few more slides here. Talking about Firefox internet history. So this is a screen capture of SQLite Manager. You could use that to do SQLite interactive lookups. So what we've done is we open a specific file. We open the cookies SQLite file up, which includes tables, and you can run queries on the data, etc. So it's a fairly straightforward if you're familiar with database objects. Same thing, we can look at downloads. Simple command, select star from Mozilla downloads, will give us all of the URL history. We can then either interact with it right there, or send it out as a database, or send it out as a spreadsheet document, and can use whatever tables we want. Where it gets a little bit more challenging is when we're talking about places, because you usually have to have some type of complex entry to actually be able to match dates and times with some of the data that's captured. So in the slides, are the slides available on the, what website is it? What is the site? So everybody knows. Blackboard? These slides are available on Blackboard, right? Because sometimes these commands are good examples to be able to use. So to read it straight out is kind of silly. How we did that is what I wanted to do is be able to get the date and time along with the actual places that were visited, and to put that into something that I can actually use, because it's getting it out of more than one table. Caching is keeping actual files in your internet history. In caching with Mozilla, it's using its own proprietary caching database, and many different files can be stored into this database, and they're a binary format. But luckily, we have tools available out there. CacheView, for example, will let you look at the actual files inside the cache. So if you look at the name, oftentimes you're going to see it's internal to a certain cache. And if we have that available, you can actually pull that literal file out of the cache using this cache view tool. And finally, for Firefox artifacts, one other thing we can consider is that if the session doesn't end cleanly, it may use a .js file to store its session in. So this is, for example, one of those things that I always like. It's to enhance the user experience. So if Firefox crashes, I think most browsers do this now. Firefox was one of the earlier ones, Safari as well, that if it crashes, it saves its session information so that when you open the browser back up, it says this had an unexpected shutdown. Do you want to restore your Windows? So that's good information for us because that can be looked at to see what was on the system at the time it crashed. Now, it's supposed to clear that cache out after the user successfully opens it up, but you may still find artifacts of that on disk. And the script itself or the JS file itself is going to contain the actual URL that was open and some other information. Okay, we will have URL history to look at in Firefox. Mail clients vary even more than web browsers. So this is the old form of mail, which some people still use pop mail, for example, versus using all webmail. Webmail artifacts you'll find in history of the browser, and not as easy as it used to be. Usually you can only get the content of webmail now from the provider. A search warrant or subpoena. Let's see. Mail, sometimes, we'll find normally there's either two types of mail, inbox or mail tier. Data formats are always plain text, so they're not encrypted. And we can just simply identify the mailbox of choice. Now, I will say that I mentioned webmail. You can recover webmail typically only from the provider. So if you do a search warrant or subpoena to Yahoo Mail or to Google Mail or another mail server or mail provider out there, oftentimes what I found is that they'll deliver that mail now in an inbox format. So knowing this format outside of individual investigations or individual system investigations, you may need to know this for large-scale analysis. So inbox is kind of a pain to analyze because it's got a lot of junk inside of it. It's plain text, so it's not doing any types of real data culling, and we have to just get through it all. But because it's plain text, we can use a lot of tools and scripts to interact with it without having to know any underlying storage structures. One way we can look through mail is we can use grep mail. It's not quite the same as grep, but it can use a lot of switches the same. And if you're looking for specific information, it's a little easier to use than standard grep if you're just looking across the mailbox. Remember, it's just one big plain text file. So if I want to look for results in just the body, for example, I throw the dash B at it. So I'm looking for a pattern that is specific to being in the body. I can look for date ranges. I can look for headers and not the mail itself, and so on. So again, grep mail. It's got very good, robust date searching options. And it also accepts before and between dates. So if we're looking for a very specific date range, this can be a very helpful tool if you're looking at email. If I don't get 300 emails a day, then I wonder if I was fired or not. I mean, frankly, I'm overwhelmed with email, so you're going to get a lot of information to look at. Examples of grep mail is looking for headers, giving it a date, anything before 12:30 a.m. in February on this particular mailbox, every day. The other example on here with dash J, dash A, dash D is looking for all emails that have deleted status. Remember, deleted doesn't mean wiped, received after February 19th. Okay. It can be pretty flexible and powerful. But it's pretty slow, especially on large mailbox files. And it's written in Perl. So not everybody's favorite anymore. It was. There was a time. Another option for some artifacts, and you have this in your scenario, is that you can look at Thunderbird, which is a mail client. Used to be used all the time. Some people still use it. You can access your pop mail with it. And it is stored in a proprietary MSF format, which is a proprietary database. And again, it's essentially a big flat text file as well. The choices we have, one of the easiest choices we have to look at this is to actually do what we call a copy over technique, which means move that into your profile, have Thunderbird installed, move that into your profile and be able to look at it as if you were the user. So you would have all the same limitations and all the same features of the client, of the Thunderbird client. The challenge to this, though, is please don't do this while connected to the internet. Don't do this while connected to the internet. Because if you connect with this, after using this technique, you copy the bad guy's profile over to your system and you connect with the internet, you're going to download all of his email that's currently sitting on the server. You don't want to do that, especially, you know, depending on the limitations of your scope. In law enforcement, for example, if you seized a system, you may have the ability to examine what's on the system, depending on the scope of your search warrant, but you don't have the ability to search the provider. And if you automatically download email from the provider, you may be violating laws in there, not to mention ethics. To do this technique, and I do recommend it going through your scenario over the next couple days, is you have to have the home partition. You have to either have it mounted or have to pull it out with sleuthkit tools. Take the user's profile to your system and include your profile.ini to point to the system's file. And then just launch Thunderbird, again, making sure you're offline. An example, again, you have these slides, is that I'm looking at an offset here, very specific, making sure that I'm only mounting the system or mounting the home directory, and then copying the, so this assumes I already looked at it to know what the name is, but I'm copying the user's profile, which is this hash number followed by default, into my own .thunderbird directory. Then I have to go in, edit the Thunderbird profiles.ini, to make sure that I include Dimitri's profile name and path. If you do this, if you follow these steps, then what's going to happen is Thunderbird's not going to open up a default profile. It's going to say, which profile do you want to open? So if you follow these steps exactly, you'll get to choose. If you choose Dimitri's, don't forget to pop that box, work offline. Couple more artifacts here, and then we'll make sure we can get those images mounted, is that instant messaging, again, a very many choices are available for instant messaging. I think most people aren't using a lot of the things that are available out there. There are literally hundreds of these, but most of us, I use Apple Message or SMS or Skype. That's about it. That's all I use anymore. But I used to have a plethora of browsers. I had Yahoo Instant Messenger. I had AOL Instant Messenger. I had Chrome. I had Pigeon. I had all kinds of things out there because they exist, and they're updated very often. One thing we're going to look at here, well, there's a couple of things we're going to look at here. One of them is Pigeon. Pigeon, very specific chat program that is multi-platform, and most of these investigative steps will work regardless if you're on Linux or Windows because they're written to be independent and portable. the idea, again, is not that we can teach you to do everything with a chat program, because they're frequently updated, there's so many of them, but you have to kind of know where to look and what kind of is going on behind the scenes to be able to put any type of strategy together. So for our baseline, we'll look at Pigeon. Pigeon stores everything in the home directory .purple. So we don't have a .pigeon directory, we have .purple, and that's development history, frankly. There will be an accounts XML that contains all of the settings that are configured, including plain text passwords. So if the user set it to store any passwords, it'll be in plain text. And that's good for us. If I have Pigeon on a user system and I can find the user's password for Pigeon or the five or six different chat applications he's using, those go into my dictionary for password attacks on other files. Buddy lists, saved messages, and then finally logs. The logs are broken out into the protocol or network. So the example at the bottom has, yes, here's my home directory with .purple, and I'm using AOL Instant Messenger. And then it is my user ID, or the bad guy's user ID, so CyberBadGuy11, and then who he's speaking with. Each conversation will be broken out into this fashion. And the date and time that the log initiated. Plain text. They are plain text, so very simple to work with. There can be, sometimes the AOL logs might be RTF, but I can still read them fairly simple. I just might get fancy colors. And two more things here. We're going to talk just a little bit about Internet Relay Chat. IRC, it's been around forever. People still use it. People still use it despite all of the new stuff that's available out there because it works. It's been working for years and years and years. It's easy to script on. It's easy to create bots. It's been a couple years, only a couple years, since I did an Internet Relay Chat investigation. I did Internet Relay Chat where it was being used by one of these hacktivist groups, like Anonymous, LoSec, those types of things. They still use this out there. And they generally, IRC does not log by default. Most clients do not log by default. And so if you think, you know, let's just talk, not to pick on Anonymous, but it's an easy one for me to say. I did an investigation with like an anonymous group that says, you know, they install their IRC clients and they tell each other, don't log anything, don't log anything. If the cops come, we don't want them to have any of these logs. And they all say, yeah, we don't log. But the first thing I do is I look for the logs, and almost every time they had logging enabled. They knew not to do it. They just decided to do it just for convenience, to look back at what was said. Sometimes you can still find it. In the XChat IRC program, which is what we're going to look at, the messages are stored in .chat, chat logs. Pretty straightforward. Usually plain text, but can be very noisy, especially if you're talking about a group chat. You might find some other saved information as well, including your nicknames and what channels you're joining, scripts that you're using, etc. Pretty straightforward, and we have this artifact to look at. Swap file. We have the swap file in this. We talked about it a little bit. It's the paging area where stuff that's moved out of active memory to provide a sort of virtualized memory system can be stored. It says not structured well. I would say it's not structured well for the forensic analysis. It's structured well for the usage of the virtual memory by the system. But unfortunately, as soon as the system's powered down, that structure and the definition of the structure goes away. So it's not that it's not structured well, it's just not stored anywhere. The structure's there. Of course, it has to be used, but once that system is powered down, you can't get that back in the same way. But it could contain other things, right? So not a Linux example, but a Windows example. We have a big problem right now in an investigation, in multiple investigations that I'm running, where the attackers are using PowerShell, Windows tool specifically, to install malicious backdoors directly into memory or credential harvesters. They are not writing to disk. Nothing is being written to disk. But we can recover some of this from live running memory and also from the page file. If that backdoor gets swapped out to the page file and they find it. Really, your best bet on the swap file, somebody's got a plug-in to try and look at Windows page file, but I haven't seen anything really good for Linux. Not that the Windows one is any good either, but at least they try. But running strings is really going to be your options, your best options, if you have the time. But it's going to generate a lot of noise. Strings are not always that useful. A lot of potential false positives. Okay, so just briefly, we looked at home directory, bash history, web browsing, email, and chat logs. So those things we know we're going to have to look at, but don't overlook the other stuff too, right? So our regular var logging types of activity, we can also look at that. So I put together, and again, you have access to these slides. So some of the things I want to make sure that you have an understanding of what we're going to look at. So you have some steps here. Look at the detailed information about the system. Look at the file system artifacts. Look at the chat artifacts. Look at the email artifacts. Look at the web history. Here's just kind of a cheat sheet of what we're going to look at. The log analysis, don't leave that out. And then at the end of the week, so by mid-morning Thursday, so we're coming in early on Thursday, 8 to noon on Thursday. Otherwise, it's 3 to 7. But by mid-morning on Thursday, have some type of chronological report put together. So I don't expect to have a full written report on this, but at least have something that you can look at with your notes, even if it's Excel, that can go through and walk me through the steps of what happened during this attack. And combine that with the widget co-findings, because that will make the case complete. So where we're at now with the scenario is that the IP address was identified as the attacker and was traced back to a dorm room in Latveria, where Dmitry Darkov was the suspect who owned the system. But the police were able to seize the system while Dmitry was in class. So the system was in his room, but he says his room was open frequently and he had frequent guests coming to his room, his dorm room. So he let them use the computer once in a while, so he says it's not him. So the police are unwilling at this point to arrest him until you can link him to the evidence of WidgetCo. So what you're going to do is take a look at this, make sure that you have a valid image, see what's on the host, compare it with what's on the server, and summarize these facts into a chronological report like Excel. PowerPoint if you want, or Word if you want, your choice. Your choice of tools is up to you. The next steps really are to get Dmitry mounted. Remember how to get it mounted? Let's walk through that then. Okay, first, I think you have it in a BZIP format, so instead of the Z switch, you'll have to send it the J switch to inflate it. Get one of those there. So I have another file here for you. It's the dimitri.ddbzip. It's the only one you should need. Wow, you can't see that at all, can you? I can't see that at all. Sorry, just deflating here. to mount this, remember we have to figure out how many partitions are in this image. Sorry. The first thing we have to do is remember run our parted command on the image. So it's got multiple partitions on it. So what I do then is I take this out and put it into a text document. I can do that until I can find FSTab is by guessing. But I think this one's not going to be as challenging. So, the next thing to do is to create a mount point. I already have one. Then I need to mount. Read-only loop. Now I need an offset. And that's where this comes back. This is offset by byte. So the very first partition is our root partition, so we can find the FS tab pretty quickly in this case. So that helps us out a lot, right? So I can look at my notes on the partitions, and I can see that SDA 1, I'm going to give it a new, column, and it's going to be slash. Two is our extended, so we're not going to get one of those. Five is our user. SDA 5 is our user. SDA 6 is var. SDA 7 is none, so if I look at that, it's probably my swap space. So I don't have to mount that one. Eight was temp. And nine was home. Read that. So the first one, I mounted as working. So each one of these, I can then nest the mounting. Remember how to do that? And so the next command would be something like this, right? So use it. Okay, so this will get, so this will get all of the file system mounted. You can also use FLS. I prefer to do a combination of both. I like to have the live systems, but I need FLS if I want to look at deleted files or deleted artifacts. Okay, swap we don't mount, and extended just points to the other four. So you've only got five to get mounted, and then again, start with the steps, figure out the version. Version is going to be important because it's going to determine where certain logs are, time zone settings are, trying to get this high level OS information out. Look through the file system for artifacts. Remember, we're trying to tie this back together with WidgetCo, so you've got a lot of places to start. There's a lot of expected artifacts from our WidgetCo investigation. And then look through chat logs, email, web history, log analysis, and anything else you can think of in that space. If you get time, look at swap space, but your rewards may not be mostly there. I focus more on the user-based artifacts. And don't forget history files and regular logs. Okay? Yep. No, it's just at the end of, on Thursday, just to be able to present to me in the class. So that, you know, you have a good solid understanding of the events that took place and why we perform certain tasks. No. No, there's nowhere to submit it to. It's never been, unless I've, yeah, I don't. Do you have any other instructions, Jan, from?
So, it isn't any deliverables to TTF, but you're going to deliver an individual report for to Lasse, yes.
Okay, thanks. I didn't know that, so good. Glad you asked. Glad you answered. Good. I'm here to help you. But this is going to be 90% on your own, so this is time for you. And I'll tell you this, we don't have enough time to do every single artifact here if you don't work together. So normally we have 10 or 15 people in here, and we break it up into two or three groups and designate parts out so that you can create this chronological report. One person working email, one person working IRC, one person working file system. However you want to do it. Usually much bigger class than three. Yeah, that was small. We've gotten bigger, and then I think because of the remote options, not as many people are here. Remember, it was mandatory to be here. It was supposed to be. Yeah. It was supposed to be. Well, I think you had an option to do something else, but I don't remember what that was. I was not really involved in that. Okay, good. Good. Okay. I'm going to shut the microphone off and let you get.
Yeah.